Yeah.
All right, folks, it's 11 o'clock, and I am going to respect those of you who get here on time by starting on time, because we have a lot of stuff to cover. Now, let me just ask real quick, I'm talking with just my voice right now, so that's the sound of my voice. Now, this is me projected, which do you prefer?
That.
That, good, okay.
Can you take your mask off?
You know, I could, but I'll just put it straight out there. One of our board, I'm on the home board, and we found out yesterday that one of our board members who went home on Saturday has COVID. So I'm being a little extra careful.
And projected with a mask.
So I'm going to wear the mask. Look, as long as the sound is okay, can you hear me all right? And just let me know if I need to up the volume, I'm glad to do that, okay? So, you may have seen on the kiosk that this class was called, or these sessions were called, the Climate Imperative and Clean Energy Solutions. But honestly, it's a climate emergency. Let's call it for what it is. So I relabeled it the Climate Emergency. I want to quickly sort of go over what the five sessions are going to cover. Please feel free to come to all, or just one, or two, or three. These sessions will be recorded, so you can go into the, you know, the library when you go home if you miss one, and get the information from there. Today we're going to talk about the climate emergency. This is the downer information, right? This is the tough stuff to look at. But I try to present it in a way that makes it clear what the pathway to solutions could be and how we could basically overcome this emergency. But the rest of it will be talking about the various solutions. And the first one is sort of some basics on clean energy and where the clean energy technology opportunities do exist today. And the message here is we can do this. We can stop putting emissions into the air. We can stop that. Both from a technical standpoint and an economic standpoint, we're there. It's just a matter of making it happen, right? And we'll talk about that, particularly in the clean energy policy and politics session four. But session three may be less familiar to you, which is there's three principles around the clean energy revolution that I think are important for people to understand, and the importance of decarbonization. And this is about not just the sources of energy we use, but how we deploy it through our heating systems, both air and water, and through our transportation, but particularly buildings. The second, distribution. You know, we have two major ways in which we're generating clean energy. The big utility, what we call utility scale projects, you know, wind farms, big solar farms, large hydro and so forth. But there is a role, an important role, that what's called distributed energy needs to play, which is energy that's being produced more locally. Not just from a sort of nice to have customer basis, but because of the nature of how our energy grids work, the need for local. And then democratization, which is right now, most parts of the country, energy is provided to you through very large, either public utilities, which is fine, or investor-owned utilities. And we have a model that's in California starting to spread other parts where we're having more publicly owned and publicly governed, smaller scale, what are called community choice agencies that are implementing programs to have clean energy much more quickly than the investor-owned utilities. And we'll talk about why those investor-owned utilities have frankly resisted that more rapid pace. And so that's an important part of accelerating the clean energy revolution. And finally, clean energy policy and politics. And all these are leading to the last session, which is going to be about, so what can you do at an individual level, in your community, at the state level, and even at the federal level to advance those solutions. Now, in the past, when I've taught this course in the past, I did it over 5 days, but the way the new cohort model works, we've got to squeeze it into 3 days. So we're going to have this session at 11 to 12 today, tomorrow, and Thursday, and then from 1:30 to 2:30 on Wednesday and Thursday. So again, feel free to come to whichever one. It won't be a problem to just stop in if you miss one. Anyway, if you can come to all of them, that would be great. So here's my goal. By the end of these sessions, I hope you have a significantly deeper understanding of the need for immediate action to address the climate emergency. That you recognize that such action will require fundamental and likely disruptive changes in how we lead our lives, both individually, in our local communities, in politics, business, and the world at large. This is not going to be a straight line. It's going to be disruptive. That's one of the key messages. But hopefully you'll come away with more knowledgeable about the many positive, life-affirming ways that this can be accomplished, and in fact leading to a world that's even more whole, healthier, and just, and more connected. So let me tell a little bit about myself, because my journey, I've gone through that same journey myself, honestly. Most of my career was as an organizational strategy consultant. I had a consulting firm called the Results Group. And most of that work was working with nonprofits, government agencies, or businesses that had a social or economic benefit mission. I have a degree in I have a doctorate in organizational psychology, and a lot of my work was the intersect between, you know, hard-nosed strategy and the people side of organizations. How do you make those two come together? Just parenthetically, I've been coming to Holden for 30 years. My wife brought me here after having been a volunteer in her college days. An interesting, or maybe not interesting, fact is I'm Jewish, my wife is Lutheran, but I'm sort of a pro-Lutheran Holden Village kind of guy. I'm also a bit of a Jew-boo, but that's a whole other story. But one of the other pieces that the way I got involved with the board is about 4 years ago when the board decided to do a comprehensive strategic plan, which some of you may have seen on the board or on the website. They asked me to help facilitate that process. So I spent about a year and a half working with the board on that. And we'll talk a little bit of what came out of that having to do with this topic. But they then invited me to join the board. So I've been on the board for 2 years also. Anyway, doing this consulting for many years. And then in 2004, I got a contract with a national environmental organization called Earth Justice. How many people have heard of Earth Justice? Their logo is Every Planet Needs a Good Lawyer. And actually, this is their jubilee year. They were founded in 1962, just like Holden, after they were part of a lawsuit against the Disney Corporation, which wanted to turn a beautiful mountain area in the Southern Sierras in California into a Disney resort. And it was out of that case that the notion that nature can actually go to court, that nature has a standing in the courts. And that's been the basis for most environmental litigation that's protected our environment since then. But anyway, this is their 60th anniversary this year of that case. Anyway, they hired me to do a strategic plan around the fact that they were organized around clean air, clean water, public lands, endangered species, but they didn't have a climate strategy. And so my job was to help them figure out how do they integrate these different ideas into a climate strategy. Out of that, I kind of had a bit of a wake-up call around, wow, you know, reading the science, understanding where we were at, I realized this is kind of an existential issue that I wanted to work on. And parenthetically, at the same time, I was working with a business that was one of the largest financiers of low-income housing using what are called low-income housing tax credits. Now, you may have heard about solar tax credits. Well, in 2005, the federal government passed a bill that allows for tax credit financing to support the development of solar. And so, because I'd had this experience with Earth Justice, I'm working with this company that has tax credit experience, I convinced that company as part of my strategy work with them to start a business providing tax credit financing for solar. The deal was, yes, they'll do that if I leave my consulting practice and come in and help start up that business. And that was MMA Renewable Ventures. So I worked there for about 3-4 years, and then the recession hit, and this low-income housing company got whacked and had to stay solvent, had to sell off some of its jewels. Our business, our MMA Renewables business, was doing very well. Unfortunately, we had to sell during hard times, but we sold that company So I started it, and then I sold it, and then I left it to start my own company, Terra Verde Energy, in 2008. And that company was dedicated to supporting schools, cities, all kinds of public agencies, water districts, transit agencies, in making the transition to clean energy, to developing solar and storage, and more recently, battery storage project paired with solar, and a bunch of other things. But I retired from that company then in 2020. I'm still the chair of the board, a major owner of that, guiding that business, and focused on the policy arena. I do a lot of lobbying and advocacy, again, like I said, primarily in California, to advance legislation, or in some cases to stop bad legislation regulations coming along, so that we can continue the accelerated adoption of clean energy solutions. So that's kind of been my journey. I want to hear more about your story. I want to, as sort of a, break the ice, get to know each other thing, I'd like you to just, in groups of three, find three people, introduce yourself by sharing one way you believe that climate change is impacting you and your community today, and one way you believe it will impact you and your community by 2030. And we use the 2030 date because essentially all the data that's out there says we have got to have this disruptive, radical change in how we live our lives by 2030 if we're going to have a world that is, livable, honestly. So that's sort of the target date. So just take 2-3 minutes to introduce yourselves and come up with an answer to that question and share that with two other people. Go. Okay, thank you. Okay. So let's just really quick popcorn. What are some of the impacts that you're observing today?
Extreme weather fluctuations.
Right.
In Northwest Washington, extreme heat, and then extreme flooding.
And fires.
And fires.
Glaciers melting.
You're experiencing that where you live?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Drought in the Southwest.
Yep. Air quality in major cities.
Ice flow in the Arctic.
Yeah.
Permafrost thawing.
Oh yeah.
Tundra fires.
Polar vortex.
Oh yeah.
All right. Good. So sometimes people say, well, wait a minute, global warming, it's freezing in Texas. Well, yeah.
That's weather.
Climate change, right? Yeah. Not global warming.
So, if I'd asked this question 10 years ago, people, maybe not so much, but it really does, it's not just our sensation. It is documented. The number of these kinds of extreme weather events are increasing in number and in severity, no question. And we're seeing it, we're having that visceral experience now in the last few years that we just haven't had necessarily before, or we didn't notice it, or we kind of could say, well, it's a 100-year storm, except we're getting 100-year storms every 2 years, right? That whole concept of 100-year storms, right?
Yeah.
All right, so looking ahead to 2030, what do you think? What do you anticipate? Just more of the same, or what?
Rising oceans.
Yeah. Rising oceans.
More water quality.
Anybody been to Miami recently?
Tried not to.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty amazing how they just sort of now expect that their streets are going to be flooded, like, all the time. Mm-hmm. What else?
Climate refugee crisis.
Climate refugees. Very good. Yeah. And frankly, what do you think happened in Syria? What was Syria about, right? It was climate change in Syria basically destroyed the livelihoods of millions of farmers, mm-hmm. right? They just didn't, part of it was a war, but part of it, they couldn't farm anymore. And where were they going to go? What else?
I'm fine, Dan. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. What else do you expect by 2030?
Food crisis?
Food crisis?
Mm-hmm. Water crisis.
Climate refugees is going to cause more conflict if you think about millions of people in Bangladesh, for example.
Yep.
Where are they going to go?
Yep.
I suspect there'll be some infertility issues as well. Human infertility and other,
Yeah, what about other species?
Yeah.
Extinction.
Okay, we're going down. We're going down in the dark hole here. We're not going to stay here. We're not going to stay here. But let me just kind of make my personal statement about this, and just see if it resonates in any way, shape, or form. Some of what I'm going to be sharing comes from my personal experience. You know, the advocacy work, the development of solar projects, et cetera, et cetera. And some of it from my research, and most of it from other people's research. A lot of it will be grim. I don't plan to sugarcoat the current facts, but despite this, I continue to be personally very hopeful that the trial that we, humanity, and all other forms of life now face will eventually lead to a world that is more whole, healthy, just, and connected. And part of that is a spiritual, religious belief. It's a faith. Part of that is my own life experience. Some of the most illuminating, important events of my life have come after or out of some of the more difficult times of my life. And I think probably other people have had that experience also. I'm hopeful that that's what humanity will get to have come out of this. But again, this is not just me. I really hope that you feel comfortable sharing your experience, your feedback, your thoughts about the issues that we covered. So, let's talk about the facts. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, this is the UN entity that releases the best in the science around climate change. It has scientists from all over the world in multiple configurations. And in 2021, they said, the future is going to be different than what it's been. That part is baked in at this point. The question is, will we make the choices now as to whether our species and others thrive or simply survive as the 21st century unfolds. One of the commentaries on this IPCC report talked about the fact that climate activists are sometimes depicted as dangerous radicals, and we are radical, because we're saying we need to fundamentally relook at how things occur. But the truly dangerous people are those countries, those businesses, those forces that are increasing the production of fossil fuels, right? Those are the people who are dangerous radicals, given what we know. And what this report and subsequent reports still continue to say, even though, time is short, is that we can cut emissions to keep the possibility of limiting the increase in the warming of the globe to levels that are sustainable, where we can thrive as opposed to just survive. So that's part of my hope. But the point is, nature is at bat today, not humans. This is a map from last year showing the continual much warmer than average, warmest average every year, right? In terms of global temperatures all over the world. Now it's not always consistent in terms of location. Some places are cooler. But over time, the record is clear in terms of the impact of carbon emissions, both in the form of carbon dioxide and in the form of methane, are heating the planet. And the physics is clear. We know the physics. In fact, there are scientists in the late 1800s who talked about how industrialization was likely going to heat the planet because they saw how CO2, increases heat. So it's not something we haven't known for a really long time. And we'll talk later about how fossil fuel companies had even more information that they withheld from us. Again, this is, you don't worry about reading the numbers. The bigger size and the upward curve is an indication of the increase over time in climate emergency declarations, be it hurricanes, floods, extreme heat, polar vortexes, as people talk about. Many of you are probably familiar with that picture on the left. That was those of you in the Northwest.
Right?
That's what it looked like. That's what it looks like today in the Midwest. It was 108 degrees in Wisconsin yesterday. In Petaluma, where I live, and I live 15 miles from the coast, right? So we get the fog and the cooling. My wife told me this morning it was going to reach 100 today at noon. And then the most recent one, I don't know if people have heard about the heat dome that descended over South Asia, 115, 120 degrees. With humidity levels that made it such that if you didn't go to a place that had cooling, you would not survive within an hour or two. So extreme heat is going to be, if it's not already in people's consciousness, is going to be sort of the big issue over the next few years. In California, and we'll talk later, we have an actual extreme heat initiative. There's a $21 billion package in our current budget proposal from our governor and legislature, most of which is focused on addressing extreme heat. So people are clearly becoming aware of this. Those of us who talked about it 10 years ago were like, we don't have to talk about it anymore. People know it. This is resulting in some really hard choices. The core mission of the National Park Service has been what? Conservation, right? That's been their historical mission. Their job to preserve iconic landscapes, right? That idea is sort of inscribed in the founding documents of the various parks around the country. But what happens when climate change makes that impossible, right? Park managers have been asking themselves that question. They're caught in the reality that they have to make choices. Which are the species, which are the things that they're going to keep, and which are the things they're going to have to just let go? And this is no longer a conservation mission. This is a choice to let things die, because we don't have an option. We don't have the option of keeping everything alive.
You've been up here for a few days. Do you know what's happened at Yellowstone?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you want to just mention what?
Well, just massive flooding that's closed the whole northern part of the park.
Right.
And the southern part was closed as well. And I think they just opened this weekend.
Yeah.
So that seems counterintuitive. Why are those areas worse off?
Which parks?
The parks.
It's not that they're any worse off than anywhere else. It's just that the degree. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. All right.
The degree of.
Well, but that says at twice the rate as the country as a whole.
Well, that I put that quote up there because it was a headline.
Oh, okay.
I should have. I guess what I've come to believe over time is, we'll talk a little bit later about climate porn. Sort of disaster porn, that, you know, twice as much here, three times as much there. It's like, what does that really mean anymore?
Okay.
Right? Given the overall context. I probably should take that quote out of it. Yeah, yeah.
I'm kind of literal.
But thank you for pointing out my inconsistency. Very important. I will be inconsistent many times.
Okay.
So, climate porn. You know, up until the last few years, I mentioned this earlier, the news and social media's primary storyline on climate was about whether this or that political leader or celebrity did or didn't believe in climate change. He said this, on the other hand, some people say, etc. But the good news is that with increasing frequency of extreme climate events, most major news outlets now have a climate desk. Right, Los Angeles Times, New York Times, your local paper, hopefully even, they have somebody who's dedicated to climate. Unfortunately, as with most media, if it bleeds, it leads. So there's still an emphasis on the disasters. But we do need to confront the reality that we are in an existential climate emergency. So that part of it, I'm good with. But as we, you know, we it's important that we know about Yellowstone. We know about heat domes in India. If we just stop there, right, then we're sort of falling into the despair and or denial cycle and not actually then taking that as an impetus to act, to change. So I try to avoid too much of the doom and gloom, and I'll talk a little bit more about this. So this is my family. In 1929, my dad is 13. He's right up there. See the resemblance? is my grandfather, my grandmother, my uncle Jaime, my great-grandfather Harry, who I never met. This is at a Seder, Passover Seder. Some of you may be familiar with that ritual. But one of the elements of that ritual, right, is to think about the plagues, right? The story of Exodus, how Moses went to Pharaoh and said, "Let my people go." And each time Pharaoh said, "Sure," and then he backed out. And so God brought the plagues. The question we have to ask ourselves today, and one of the things that we do in the Passover Seder, by the way, is we recite the plagues, but for each plague we recite, we spill wine onto our plate. Because even though we needed the plagues to get out of Egypt, the suffering, we feel bad, and we want to atone for this, we need to atone for and pay for the suffering that we caused. And the question we need to ask ourselves today is, how many plagues do we need before the Pharaoh in us, right, the Pharaoh in our society, stops making excuses, right? And we do fundamentally change our behavior. So, there is a better way. If we succeed in accelerating climate change, addressing climate change quickly enough, we may not reverse the catastrophes that the last five decades have saddled us with, because it really is 90%+ of the emissions have been in the last five decades. It hasn't been that long that we've created the problem. We may be able to, in the words of Alex Stephan, snap forward into a global boom of sustainable prosperity and systems ruggedization that not only enable us to be largely successful in combating climate change, but leaves us better off than they are now. And again, the primary barrier here is not money. It's not cost. It's really going to be about our overall policy actions. And policy actions sounds like this funny word, right? Policy actions about people making decisions, right? And people in power, and people power, making the people in power make the right decisions. And there are numerous roadmaps of how this transition could happen. You know, I have, in my business, right, we put solar into 400 schools in California, okay? Net, those schools have saved $70 million over the last 10 years on their electricity bills. That's $70 million that's gone into the classroom, not to the utility company. That's $70 million they would not have had. And this is net of not just the cost of construction, but the cost of financing and the cost of on and going operations and maintenance for you engineer types who recognize that you can't just build something and leave it alone, right? So all the cost of doing this, they're actually saving, and every year it's more. Every year it's more money that they're saving. So it's not about the cost. It's a better way. Oh, by the way, one principal, one school said, you know, one of the best things about having these solar panels over our parking lots is that teachers fight to get here early enough to get under the shade. So I never have to worry about teachers getting here on time. And oh, by the way, the kids are getting here on time also. They want to be under the shade structure. So, and oh, by the way, those shade structures shade the parking lots, which reduces the heat island that impacts the buildings. So there's all kinds of ways. And oh, by the way, those solar structures are so interesting to kids that they're getting into math and science in ways that, you know, every year I go to four or five schools and do a little thing, and, you know, about solar, and, you know, it's a really exciting career opportunity. Anyway, so there are positives about the challenge that we have here. There is a better way. But it means we have to reject both denial and despair. And oh, by the way, the other alternative that Mimi was telling me about, our program manager, she said, there's also people who talk about, there's people who go into denial, there's people who go into despair, and there's people who basically go into party, because the world's going to end anyway. Let's party, right? We can't do that either. Sorry, that would be a good one, but yeah, we can't do that either. By the way, it's getting kind of warm in here, which is the first time that's happened in about 2 weeks that I've been here. I'm going to open some doors. Can somebody open that door over there? We need a little circulation. Speaking about warming, and if anybody wants to open windows, that's cool also. Yeah, there you go. Oh, that's nice. Feel that breeze?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so we're going to go down into the dark place again. I like to warn you, so, you know, it's not too good. The best scientists in the world are now saying that as bad as things seem today, and as you understand they are today, they're going to get worse, and it's going to happen more frequently. But if that's where we stop, I think our only choices are denial and despair. It's two states of mind that keeps us from doing anything about the problem. So the position I take, or I choose to take, is that, yeah, the problem is bad, it's big, and it's getting worse. But I want to lead a life where I can take every action I can to both address the worst problems and at the same time develop solutions to make the world a better place, more just, peaceful, healthier, peaceful, we talked about conflicts, healthier and sustainable for all God's creation. So let me give you a story that gives me hope. So in 2009, I recognized this startup business, it was me and two other people, that one of the places that was suffering most from the cost of energy were schools in the Central Valley in California. I don't know how many people are familiar with the Central Valley. It's the agriculture, it's the, you know, fruit and vegetable breadbasket of the country. It's where a lot of, you know, almonds, oranges, tomatoes, all kinds of things grow. And frankly, it's the reddest, quote unquote, most Republican and conservative politically part of California. Right? It's the only place where, frankly, non-Democrats are voted into office. The Clovis Unified School District is in that community, in that area. It's one of the largest districts in California. It's like number 12 or 13. And they spend a lot of money on electricity, keeping their classrooms cool, right? Because we feel 100 degrees in Petaluma today. They were feeling 100 degrees 2 months, 3 months out of the year, you know, 10 years ago. Now it's in the teens that they get those kind of temperatures. When I approached the district about, how about this solar thing, they were like, the deputy superintendent for business operations pulled out this pile of proposals that he had gotten from various solar companies, said, I don't get this stuff, it doesn't make any sense to me. I said, that's fine, I'll make it simple, and we worked with him. And we eventually came to the conclusion that the only way he thought he could pay for this, and this was a big project, it was a $25 million project, to put solar at a subset of his schools, because he has 90 schools. He couldn't commit to doing all 90, but he would do it as a subset to see how it worked. But he had to get his school board to come along, right? And so we made presentations. It took over a two-year period, and finally we got to the point where the board said, we'll do this, but the only way we're going to do it is if our voters board wasn't willing to go out and do it without voter support. We need to get our voters to support this. And so, and we're gonna need to get our voters to pay for it with a bond measure, where the voters basically would say, we're willing to be taxed to pay for a bond that would finance these projects. And so he was like, I don't know how we're gonna get that done, because we have a really, really powerful Tea Party in our community, and they don't like taxes. They don't like being taxed. I said, well, let's see what we can do. So he set up a meeting with the chair of the Clovis Tea Party, right? And he said, make a presentation to him and see what you think. So I sat down with this guy, and I went through all these slides, and I definitely emphasized, this is gonna save the school district money, right? This will save money. You'll be able to pay back that bond and save the district money ongoing pretty quickly because of the economics of the project and so forth and so on. And I went through, but I started with all my slides about climate change and the environment, and he said, look, Rick, I don't care about any of that stuff. Show me the money. I showed him the money. And as a result, he decided to be the chair of the campaign to pass this tax measure. He wasn't doing it for environmental reasons, right? Although, 10 years later, he'd become a fervent supporter of solar and the environmental benefits. But we had to start where he was. That's the key point here. You start where people are on this change process. He saw the economic benefit, and now, of course, his district has saved millions of dollars. In that $70 million, his district has saved about $5 million. They've solarized all the schools. They've now put battery storage in a number of the schools. I'll get into the economics of that later. But the point being, you got to start where people are. You can't be despairing just because he's the chair of the Tea Party, right? You find his interest, her interest, you start there, and then you bring them around. So that's a story that gives me hope. And then, like I said, 10 years later, there's me. This is my ego picture. There's me. There's Arnold Schwarzenegger. And there's Jerry Brown. 10 years later, Clovis High School, the state decides to celebrate that California has a million solar projects. Right? That was when Arnold was the governor. I don't know if you heard this, he was actually the champion of solar. He was the one who pushed through something called the California Solar Initiative with the Democratic legislature. And Jerry Brown then followed him, and although Jerry had many years ago supported this, but he followed Schwarzenegger and continued those programs. We actually now, this was December 2019, we now have 1.3 million solar projects in California. So, again, start small, start where people are at, and, we can get there. So, let's talk about hope. I want you to, again, with your little group of three, or you can do some new people, consider the possibility that the climate emergency does, in fact, create opportunities for building a better world. Share one change you would hope to come out of this opportunity in your local community, in the United States, and the world at large. What's one change you would hope would come out of this crisis? Right? Crisis breeds opportunity is basically the message here. What are the things you'd like to see come out of it? So turn to your neighbors, have a little conversation, and we'll talk about it. Okay? 3 minutes.
Showers or anything, so they
Okay, let's draw it together here. So, what are some of the changes you're hopeful to see? You'd like to see in your community, in your country, your world, what are some of the changes?
Leadership of young people.
Absolutely.
New jobs that don't even exist now.
New jobs, yeah. And they're out there. You know that in California, there are more people working in solar than in all the utilities and all the oil fields. And California's, you know, one of the largest oil producers. More jobs than solar. Now, the state's doing some stuff that could screw that up, but we're going to fight that. But anyway, what else?
Solar enables poor communities around the world to bypass the need for power plant infrastructure.
And distributed solar in particular.
Yes.
What else?
I would hope there'd be a change in understanding of how we have to really work with creation in some ways to use it. We've got a tidal differential, the second highest in the United States, and we're not using that kind of stuff. In the world, yeah. And then we've got thermal stuff up there in Alaska, not even considering that kind of stuff.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I'll riff off of that if I say. My hope, my change is that all the things that divide us, right? The Tea Party versus this, the this versus that, this brings us together. We come together.
Right? A spiritual awakening,
spiritual
awakening.
Cohesiveness. Yeah, a cohesiveness. Uh-huh. Yeah. What else?
More livable human scale cities.
I'm sorry?
More livable human scale cities, communities.
Yeah.
That's cars.
Nice. Because the honest God truth is, more people are going to be living in cities. Let's just be real. And actually, cities are the most energy efficient. But okay, cool. We don't have to go down that path. You have one over here, I'm sorry.
Taking the power away from the corporations that especially benefit with the solar, or that benefit from fossil fuel use, and making it more local, or at least more conscientious.
Nice. One or two more.
There are a lot of regimes that produce a lot of oil that are not particularly interested in justice.
Right.
Just not dealing with deals with them.
Gee, let's see. Who's the second largest oil producer in the world?
Russia.
No, what country?
Oh, Russia.
Russia.
Yeah.
How's justice being advanced in Russia these days?
Yeah, it is.
Okay, we can go on for, this is great, this is a great list. Couple of final thoughts and then I'll let you go to lunch. Again, we can do this. There's an organization called Rethink X. The people in that organization are futurists. And 20 years ago, they predicted that the price of solar would be the cheapest source of energy today. They were the only people who predicted that, right? And they were right. They were people who predicted that by the 2020s, we would be moving towards electrification of transportation. Nobody believed that 20 years ago. I mean, when I started my company in 2008, Terra Verde, you know, the biggest obstacle I had was just people didn't believe that this stuff was gonna work, right? I mean, it was called alternative energy, right? It's the alternative. It's not the main source of energy. You'll see tomorrow how wrong they were. But these same people have done extensive studies, and they basically said that if the world recognizes this dramatic shift and ends protection, this is a key, ends protection for the incumbent destructive industries, as well as invest strategically in the most optimal sectors and technologies, humanity will be able to eliminate 90% of global carbon emissions within the next 15 years. This is faster, again, this is faster than conventional wisdom. It's faster than what the IPCC, you know, the UN group, even though they're forward thinking, the US government believe is possible. Saving trillions, I've already saved 70 million, saving trillions of dollars in the process and ushering in a new era of post-carbon prosperity. Why do we think we can do this? Horses were the dominant mode of transport for thousands of years, and donkeys and oxen and whatever. But within 10 to 15 years, you didn't see horses, right? The classic example is people who thought investing in buggy whip companies was a safe investment, right? In 1910, if you invested in buggy whip companies, you were set, right? Phones. There's some people in here probably too young to recognize what that thing on the right is. You remember? One ringy dingy dingy. Two ringy dingy dingy. Remember laughing?
Laughing. Lily Tomlin.
Three ringy dingy dingy. Okay, sorry. I don't mean to be an old fogey, but check out laughing. It really is. It's really funny. But, oh my God. Think how fast that transformation took place. We could do this, right? We could do this other transformation. It's on its way. Now, what you'll be hearing is that as fast, and by the way, solar and wind are the fastest growing sources of energy now. I'll show you charts. In the last 2 to 3 years, it's like coal is there, natural gas is going there, solar and wind are going there. And nobody said this was going to happen, right? It's only in the last 3 or 4 years when it's happening. How many people have heard of ESG, right? Environmental, social, governance approach to investing? Nobody heard of that 5 years ago. Now all the money is going into ESG. So the world is waking up to this. We can do this. And if you come to the rest of my sessions, you'll see how we can do this. One more thing and I'll let you go. So some of you may recognize Greta Thunberg. She said something very profound. 15 out of the mouths of babes, youth leadership, etc. She said, she stood on the steps of the Swedish parliament on Friday afternoons, challenging her government to take action on climate. That's how she started. It wasn't anything fancy. She just got up, she just took off from school, stood on the steps. And within a few months, millions of children around the world took up her challenge. She said, the one thing we need more than hope is action. Because sometimes people fall into that despair and denial and hopelessness. But once we start to act, you see hope everywhere, right? You just got to do stuff. So the rest of our sessions will be addressing the many ways, big and small, we can and we must take action. And I appreciate you all coming today. Hope to see you around the village. We can have, please come, feel free to talk to me about any of these topics anytime. Hope to see you in the rest of the session.
Thank you.